Well, open your Bibles with me to Genesis chapter 15. We continue in our study of the patriarchs, specifically looking at Abram. The Easter break seems so long ago, and getting reconnected to this passage of Scripture can be very difficult. But as we look at this outline that continues to build, Abram has most recently defeated this Eastern coalition of kings led by Chedorlaomer, who came down into the Transjordan to collect the duty that was not being paid, and then went to war within the Transjordan area, specifically the city-states of Sodom. There we know that Lot was taken captive, that Abram came to rescue Lot from that captivity. And as Abram is returning home, he meets a mysterious character by the name of Melchizedek, the king priest of ancient Jerusalem. And in this encounter, Melchizedek blesses Abram, and Abram gives to Melchizedek a tenth of all the spoils of war, taking nothing for himself, but allowing the king of Salem to take the spoils with him. And so what this communicates to us is that Melchizedek is superior to Abram. Melchizedek served the Lord long before Abram was called to be the father of Israel, and hundreds of years before Israel became a nation and the Mosaic Law was given. And so after returning home, chapter 15, verses 1 through 6, tell us that God speaks to Abram. He reaffirms the call that is on Abram's life. And this portion of God's conversation with Abram centers on the promise of an heir, which Abram and Sarai do not yet have. Abram mistakenly thinks that he's going to have to appoint an heir from one of his servants to become his ancestry, if you will. But God confirms in these early verses of 15 that Abram's heir would come from his own body. And we're told that Abram believed God at this point, and it was credited to Abram as righteousness. Abram's faith brought to him the righteousness of God. And this verse, 15:6, provides the universal salvation principle, and that is faith equals righteousness. Righteousness does not come by what we do. It does not come by what we believe. It does not come by the God that we surrender to. Righteousness comes by placing a total faith in the finished work of Christ on the cross, regardless of what we do or don't do. And so this is exampled for us from the life of Abram all the way back into the book of Genesis. So chapter 15 continues with God speaking to Abram and confirming the promises made to him. And here it focuses on the covenant that is going to be ratified. What God has promised to Abram, and that he would be the father of a nation, that he would have descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky or the sand on the shore, that he would be a great blessing, and through him all the families of the world would be blessed. Now this covenant is going to be ratified. So together we're going to read verses 7 through 21 of chapter 15. We're going to read this in its entirety, and then we'll come back and look at this in smaller sections. So it says, "And he, God, said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? He said to him, Bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land. From the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Raphaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite. So a very lengthy description of this covenant that is going to be ratified in Abram's hearing as a confirmation of the promise that God has made to him. And so this begins again with repeating the promise of an heir, and it continues the promise of the land that God is going to give to Abram. So letter A in our outline, as the covenant is ratified, is God's promise. Verse 7, and he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. So the promise made by God to Abram has been repeated several times at very significant parts of Abram's life. This has likely been 7 to 10 years since Abram left Ur of the Chaldeans. He's encountered various trials along the way. And so again, God is repeating the promise. Abram is now in the land. He's been here for years, but he has no people. He has no ancestry that is going to inherit the land. So God reminds him that you will have an heir from your own body. And again, God reminds Abram of the initial call to follow him while he was still living in the land of Ur of the Chaldeans. Now the phrase here, I am the Lord who brought you out, is incredibly significant. First of all, it is a clear statement of the unique role that God plays in the universe. The phrase here, I am the Lord, is the Hebrew word singular for Yahweh. Basically, he says, Yahweh brought you out from. So it indicates his sovereign rule over Abram, over the promised nation of Israel that is going to come from Abram, and over the world in general that God has made. He is, after all, the great I Am, and this is all infused in the understanding of what the word Yahweh, the name and title for God, actually means. Another reason that this is very important is this phrase here, I am the Lord who brought you out, is going to be repeated to Israel with the inauguration of the Mosaic Law. So after Moses has been used by God to lead the Israelites out of slavery under the hand of the Egyptians, and as God is giving to Moses the Mosaic Law, he says this in Exodus chapter 20, verse 2, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now remembering that Moses very likely wrote this account of Genesis during the period of the wilderness wandering, he is likely retelling of this ancient story of Israel's beginning, and what Abram is telling Israel at this point, and what he has spoken through Moses would not be lost upon the nation of Israel. What Moses has told them, as God told Moses, is very similar to what God told Abram and did for Abram by bringing him out of the land of Ur of the Chaldeans. God's covenant with Abram and with the nation of Israel are based upon God's sovereign act of salvation. Just as God has sovereignly called Abram out of Ur of the Chaldeans, God has also brought the nation of Israel out from slavery under the hand of the nation of Egypt. Very, very similar in what is being said, and it would be very, very similarly understood by both Abram and by Moses' Israel. So Abram was delivered from Ur in his idolatrous moon worship, and Israel is sovereignly saved through their deliverance from slavery at the hands of Egypt. As we continue in this chapter, we're going to see what happens here with Abram, and in Canaan neatly foreshadows the setting of Moses at Sinai and what takes place during his encounter with God on Sinai. So we see here of this initial ratification. Gosh, what happened there? Well, you're going to get a lot in advance. My slides got bungled around somehow, so just look at letter B. I don't know how this happened. I double-check this all the time. So the second thing that we see here is Abram's question in verse 8. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? He's asked, I don't have an heir, one's going to come from your body. Know for certain that you will possess this land. Abram says, how, O Lord, may I know that I will possess it? So Abram is a man of faith, and his faith has been credited to him or reckoned to him as righteousness, but we see here that his faith is still developing and it is significantly hindered by uncertainty. What Abram is likely saying is, God, I believe what you're saying, but I just don't understand how this is going to happen. The New Testament corollary to this is the man who came and asked Jesus to heal him, if you can heal me, and Jesus says, if I can heal you, and he says, I believe, help me in my unbelief. And that's the dilemma that you and I live in today. We believe, but we need God to help us in our unbelief. So Abram has no heir, so how is fulfilling the promise of inheriting this land by his ancestry going to happen? It's 1 + 1 = 3. God, I just don't see how this adds up. Abram believes, yet he just doesn't understand how this is going to happen. So God is going to validate this promise to Abram in the most intense way to date. And so letter C, as you see here, is ratification preparation. So God has brought Abram to this point to understand in no uncertain terms what it is God is going to do. And so he says in verses 9 and 10, he said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the bird. So we look at this and we say, yeah, okay, God's going to make a covenant with Abram, but I don't know what this means. I don't know why this happens. Well, this is a very common practice in the ancient world. This covenant ratification process was probably not new to Abram. It was very common in the ancient world. The only detail that we are provided is the specific animals that Abram is being instructed to bring, the age that these animals are going to be, and that they are divided into pieces. There's a cow, a sheep, and a goat, a ram. They're 3 years old. They're at their prime value. They're able to produce milk, and they're also able to breed. The 5 animals listed here would be animals used in the future sacrifices prescribed in the Mosaic Law, although the word for pigeon in the Mosaic Law is different. So as Moses has given modern Israel the Mosaic Law, or will give them, they're going to go, oh yeah, yeah, that sounds familiar. That's what happened to Abram. So we're not told that Abram was instructed to cut the animals in two. It's either that God told Abram and it just isn't recorded, or Abram knew what to do because of the commonness of this covenant ratification process. So in the ancient world, a covenant between two parties would be made in this fashion. An animal is sacrificed. It would be divided into two pieces. There would be a pathway between each half of the carcass. And then each individual of the party would pass through that passageway between each half of the carcass. And passing through would be their commitment to stand up to their end of the bargain in the covenant that is being ratified. The ceremony dramatizes a self-imposed curse should either of the parties break their pledge. In a sense, they would be saying, if I break my word, may I become like this severed animal. So think about that. If you were to go out into your field and kill a cow and divide it into two, and you're looking at this dead animal, its carcass, and you pass through it saying, I swear I will uphold my end of the bargain, and you're passing through this aisle between this dead animal, it would be a pretty vivid picture for you, wouldn't it? And we don't have anything like that. We have, for example, a marriage ceremony, and you stand across from this other person, and you say, I promise, I will, I do. You give a ring, you make a pledge, right? That's what we're familiar with. In the ancient world, it was much more vivid. In the same way that a sacrifice as a burnt offering would be very vivid to the people who saw this animal come up on the altar, saw it lose its life, and saw it burnt up as a means of forgiveness for your sin. Very, very personal identification in what is taking place. Now, these animals in this covenant ratification were not burned on the altar, but they are sacrificed in the sense that they are giving their lives, they are being killed as a part of this covenant ceremony. So this is what is taking place, very, very familiar to Abram, whether God gave him the details and it's not recorded, or Abram knew the details and God didn't need to tell him, that's moot. What is important is that we understand what is taking place here. Now verse 11 seems kind of odd, but it says, the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Now, you and I can drive down 82 or 842 or any of the rural roads here in Pennsylvania, and we could see the birds of prey hovering overhead, and we would say, huh, something must be dead over there. I wonder what it is. There's a period of time that has passed since these animals have been killed and separated, and now you can envision Abram sitting on the ground going, wait a minute, get away, shoo, shoo. And he's constantly fending off these carcasses that are trying to feed on these dead animals. Well, there's some foreshadowing here that isn't very obvious to us. Verses 12 through 16 are going to provide some of that foreshadowing. And as we go through this and explain it, thank you to the scholars who can figure this stuff out, you're going to go, oh, I get that. That makes a little bit more sense now than it did. So verses 12 through 16 are a prophecy of what is going to happen to Abram's future ancestry. In view of that reality, verse 11 seems to connect the severed animals as Israel and the birds of prey as the Egyptians who would enslave Israel, or Israel's enemies who are constantly seeking to attack them. And here is Father Abraham defending the nation of Israel symbolically as he awaits for this covenant to be ratified. So this is what is going on, and it isn't so obvious to us. And so letter D, as we look at verses 12 through 16, are the covenant details. Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. So Abram's trance, remember this is a vision that he's having, this trance is described as a deep sleep. The term here is associated with divine revelations in dreams and visions. In several other parts of the Old Testament, the same terminology is used, and for the sake of time, I didn't show you where these are used. And here, this visionary deep sleep is imposed by the Lord. Now, Abram is not sitting there and getting sleepy and then kind of falling over asleep. That's not what's happening. He is in a trance-like state imposed upon him by the Lord, and God is speaking to him, and God is showing him of this prophetic reality for his future ancestry, and this is described as terror and great darkness falling upon Abram. He isn't asleep. He is now being very likely shaken to his core as this terror and great darkness falls upon him. Very similarly, this is what takes place at the inauguration of the Mosaic Covenant. It says for us in Exodus 19, verses 16 through 18, as Moses met with the Lord, so it came about on the third day when it was morning that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp were terrified. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. Now I can promise you the nation of Israel wasn't sitting there going, wow, this is kind of interesting. I've never seen anything like this before. This must be God speaking to us. This is pretty important. Maybe we should take a listen to this. That's not what's happening. They are terrified violently with all that they are experiencing. It's the same image of what is now enveloping Abram in this trance-like vision. He is overwhelmed in darkness and filled with terror as God is speaking to him. And oh, by the way, this darkness and great terror also accompanies the inauguration of the new covenant of Christ's blood being shed on the cross. Matthew 27, verse 45. Now from the sixth hour, which is midday, darkness fell upon the land until the ninth hour, which would be mid-afternoon. You have to know that when all of a sudden darkness came over Jerusalem, and the sun was shrouded by clouds, people noticed. They looked around and said, something's happening here. I don't understand what's going on. So there is this darkness and this terror that accompanies these very significant inaugural moments in the lives of these people. Abram, the nation of Israel at the foot of the mountain of Sinai, and then the inhabitants of Jerusalem when Jesus was dying on the cross. So it is in this deep trance-like state that God tells Abram how, to whom, and when the land would be given. Now remember, what God has said up to this point is that I am giving you this land and your descendants will inherit it and you will be a great blessing. Well, God is going to provide a lot of detail for Abram that he has not yet heard. So first thing we're going to see here, letter I, is the how of the inheritance, and the how is oppression. Verse 13 and 14, God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, not this land, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. Now, as you hear that, knowing what takes place in Genesis and then in Exodus and how all of that is complete, you go, aha, I kind of understand a little bit more about this now. So Abram asked the question at the beginning of this encounter, how can I know for certain that I will inherit this land? And God answers and says, know for certain. Prophesying in round numbers, God foretold that Abram's ancestry would be enslaved for 400 years in an undesignated land, a land not their own. We know that it's the land of Egypt. We know the story that at the end of Genesis, Joseph brings his family to Egypt because he has ascended into a very high position within Pharaoh's household. He provides for his family. They stay there for a number of years. They enjoy this protected position. But as the years passed, 400 of those years had passed, this favored position evaporated, and they were eventually treated very, very harshly. They were incredibly numerous, and the new Pharaoh who was in town says, this is not a good thing for us. These people are numerous. What's going to happen if they revolt against us? And so they began to oppress them very, very severely. Exodus 1:11 would say, so they appointed taskmasters over them, the Israelites, to afflict them with hard labor, and they built Pharaoh's storage cities, Pithom and Raamses. And so this was the reality for the nation of Israel. Through great hardship for a number of years, probably decades, they lived under this kind of reality. So Abram's descendants of inheritance, the nation of Israel, would be born out of severe hardship, pictured by the terror and great darkness falling over Abram. So we think about the slavery that Israel endured. We think about people even today in other parts of the world who are living in these kinds of conditions, and we say that's probably not very enjoyable. That's probably a very hard life. Well, yeah, it's described for us picturally here as darkness and great terror. This is the life of many, many people in our world today. It isn't reserved just for these brief periods in time, but it's a reality even now. So Egypt, who would enslave the nation of Israel, and they would be enslaved for over 400 years, Egypt would eventually be punished by God through the 10 plagues. The 10 plagues would culminate in the death of the firstborn sons and all firstborn animals. And the crying out of Egypt was so great that they sent the nation of Israel away and they said, here, take our jewelry, take our silver, here's a bunch of clothing, go away in good riddance. They left rich. They were escorted out of Egypt's boundaries. The terror and the darkness was briefly subsided because God had delivered them, rescued them out of this slavery. And by the way, the word Exodus means deliverance. And so this is what God is prophesying to Abram, that this is going to be the reality of your future ancestry. They will be enslaved. It will be very, very difficult. But I will judge them, and I will deliver them. So letter II, the who of inheritance, very, very disappointedly for Abram, is not you. You are not the one that's going to inherit this land. It is your ancestors that is going to inherit this. Verse 15 says, as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. So Abram will not die under the darkness of great oppression, but he will also not see the land possessed by his descendants. I would imagine that was probably a difficult reality for Abram to contend with. But God said this, no, for certain. Now, III, the when of the inheritance is 400 years. Verse 16 says, then in the fourth generation, they will return here from the land that is not their own. They will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So the term generation here that is used here, the fourth generation, can be understood several different ways in Hebrew. It is known to refer always as a span of time, but the span of time differs depending upon the period in Israel's history that it is being used. So as an example, a generation can mean 20 years. as in denoting the age of Israel's adult population. So a generation would be every 20 years, and at the 20th year, these individuals would no longer be young men, they would be adult men. And so that is one way to understand a generation as 20 years. It can also mean 40 years, and that referred to the wilderness generation who waited for the 40 years of time to pass before they would enter into the promised land. And here, generation means 400 years, since we know that Abram's descendants were enslaved to Egypt for 430 years. As a way to verify this, Isaac was born to Abram in his 100th year. So, as some words in English can mean different things, there are many words in Hebrew that can mean many other things than what we would generally understand from its most common usage. So fourth generation is probably used here as an expression conveying the idea of completeness. So in the completed time, God's sovereign plan for Israel to inherit the land would come, but not until the sin of the Amorite has been fulfilled. Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about the sin of the Amorite and who they were and what they did, but we would be here for a very long time. So we're not going to do that. We'll pass over that. You can go and look at the Amorites on your own study and learn more about them. They were a very, very wicked people, and God justly dealt with their sin. So letter E as we continue through here. Unilateral ratification. This is the most important part of this entire narrative. Circle this in your Bible because this is very, very important. Verse 17, it came about when the sun had set. It has not set up to this point. It's just darkness of the reality of what God is prophesying to Abram. When the sun had set, that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. So God makes a fiery appearance as a smoking fire pot radiating an orange flame in the darkness. Now this is a theophany, a visual manifestation of God. Abram is not having a bad dream. He's not seeing something in a dream. God is appearing in the form of this smoking fire pot, and in this appearance, he passes between the space of the severed animals that are put in place for this covenant ratification. So Abram is in this sleep-like trance as God is speaking to him, and he is seeing this fire pot as he is receiving this vision from God, and he sees this unmistakable smoking oven and this flaming torch. Know for certain that I have given you this land. Moses would view a similar phenomenon in this theophany when the burning bush would begin speaking to him, and Moses very clearly understood, this is God. The nation of Israel saw the same thing as we already referenced in Exodus 19:18. The Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. What is absolutely imperative to understand is this. God passed between the severed animals in a unilateral, unconditional covenant with Abram. Abram did not pass through. Now, what does that mean? It means that God said, "Know for certain, I have given your descendants this land." He ratifies this one-way covenant by passing through. Abram never got up and walked through. And what it means is God is making a non-breakable, unconditional promise to Abram. No matter what you do, no matter what your people do, this covenant will stand. That is what a unilateral, unconditional covenant means. It would be like our marriage ceremony, and you are making this vow, and you're making this commitment to the person you're going to marry, and they're sitting on a seat. They're not there. They're not saying, me too. They're not looking at you with tears rolling down their face saying, that's so sweet. I really appreciate that. I'm going to do my best. That's not taking place here. God unconditionally and unilaterally makes this covenant with Abraham, meaning it is unbreakable. It cannot be broken. This God-authored promise was not dependent upon Abram making a like oath to him. This is very simply God's sovereign promise to give this land to his descendants. This Abram can know for certain. As verse 18 will tell us, God makes a covenant with Abram. It is the first time this terminology is used anywhere in Genesis. And God now focuses on the land's perimeters and its occupants. And I can just tell you, we can get bogged down in here for 30 minutes and we're not going to do that. Verse 18 to 21 say, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, and the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, and the Raphaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. So God paints the perimeter of the land that Abram's descendants will inherit. He mentions 10 of the nations as a representation of the peoples that are in that land. So the river mentioned here is not likely the Nile River. It's what is known as the Wadi El Arish, which is in the northeastern part of the Sinai Peninsula. So the Nile River runs this way, and there is another tributary that runs off this way, and it is commonly known as the border of Canaan, as referenced in many, many other books of the Old Testament. So the river is to the great Euphrates River. It's not the great river of Egypt, which would be the Nile. The great river Euphrates, and that creates the perimeter of the boundary that God is giving to Abram's descendants. Now, the full extent of inhabiting this area was at its closest under the rule of David. It receded under the rule of Solomon. And today, modern Israel occupies a significant portion of this land, but Israel has never occupied to the full extent the land that was promised to them. Now let me ask you this question. Whose fault is that? Is that God's fault or is that Israel's fault? Well, it's Israel's fault. Because as you go through and read and study Israel's history, they consistently disobeyed. They stood before the Lord and they made an oath to God. And their breaking of that oath brought about their discipline, their chastisement, eventually leading to the falling of the northern and the southern kingdom, of them being dispersed into surrounding countries as they were punished. So the reality that they've never fully occupied the land promised to them is not God's fault. It's not God's inability to provide that for them. It's very simply Israel's fault for not doing what they were supposed to do. So the nations listed here are not to be understood as an exhaustive list of all the people, but as a representative sample of the peoples that were there in that time. In fact, if you go through and read specifically in the book of Joshua, Israel would encounter many of these and others not listed as they would begin the conquest of the land promised to them. But here, Abram is assured through this unilateral covenant by God that his people would possess this land. So this will be an encouragement to the people under Joshua's rule as they are in the process of expanding their boundaries. Under David's rule, as they experienced fierce opposition, it would be an encouragement through the diaspora when Israel was dispersed in the neighboring countries, and it would also be an encouragement to Jerusalem of Jesus' day when it fell in AD 70. The Jewish people always believed in a literal fulfillment of all that God had promised of them. And while there is truth in that, we know that through the New Testament, the completion of what God has promised is very much of a spiritual nature and not a physical nature. For example, Jesus the Messiah was believed to be a literal, physical, military ruler who would reestablish the boundaries of Israel and would overthrow wicked Rome and reestablish God's rule on the earth. But we know that's not God's plan. It was a spiritual leader, a spiritual government that he would rule over. This is why Paul would say in Galatians 3:29, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants, heirs according to the promise. As Gentiles, you were not a part of that promise. As a Gentile, you were not a descendant of Abraham, but the spiritual reality of what God promised and with what God intended to fulfill is realized spiritually through Jesus Christ. The promises of God are made to the spiritual heirs of Abram, both Jew and Gentile. Why Paul would say in Galatians 3:13 and 14, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree, in order that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we would receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. Rather than this literal fulfillment that the Jew understood and cling to, it is a spiritual promise that you and I are partakers of because we have been joined to the promises made to Abram by God through our faith, which has made us righteous, just as Abram's faith also made him righteous. Abram's God is the God of creation, the God of this universe. He is the sovereign God who orders the steps of history. He is the long-suffering God whose kindness reaches out to the loss of our world today. He is the sovereign God who guides us through the sufferings by which we enter into His kingdom. And He is the one upon whom the covenant curse fell, so that we guilty ones who trust in Him would become heirs of all the blessings made to Abram. We serve a mighty God, and I believe that we should say, as God said, know this for certain, I will fulfill the promises that I have made. Would you pray with me, please?